Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We're a nation that prides itself on its religious freedom and its constitutional separation of church and state. Nevertheless, religion has played a major role in our history. Our guest this week, Mark Knoll, has written an intriguing account of the history of religion in America, and he will be joining us to discuss that book with Talking History's Fred Nielsen. And after that, Cushing Strout will offer us his thoughts on the relationship between historical novels and history and what fictionalized accounts have to offer us as students of the past. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, June 27, 1829, James Smithson, an eminent English scientist, died in Genoa, Italy. The publication of his will caused a stir both in Europe and the United States. Smithson bequeathed his entire estate to his nephew, but stipulated that if his nephew were to die without an heir, then everything would go to the United States, a country Smithson had never even visited, to found an institution dedicated to, quote, the increase and diffusion of knowledge. 6 years later, Smithson's nephew died childless, and within 2 years, 11 boxes of gold sovereign, with the incredible value for the time of $500,000, were shipped to the United States. Congress voted to create a museum, and when President James K. Polk signed the measure, the building known as the Castle was built. Today, the Smithsonian Institution is comprised of many buildings, which include, among its better-known sites, the National Portrait Gallery, the National Museum of Space History, and the National Museum of American History.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, following up on an interview we did about 6 months ago with Alfred Brophy on the Tulsa Riot of 1921, a lawsuit has been filed over 80 years later to have the city and county provide reparations for the riot's victims, about 100 of whom are still living. The lawsuit, filed by attorneys Johnny Cochran and Charles Ogletree, alleges that in 2001 the Oklahoma State Legislature, through the Oklahoma Commission to Study the Tulsa Riot, admitted that city and county officials failed to take action to calm or contain the riot, and that in some cases they became participants in the violence that left 300 dead and thousands homeless. To hear our interview with Alfred Brophy again, visit our website at oah.org and click on Talking History for the week of December 9, 2002. And in another item in the news, black leaders in Frankfort, Kentucky are demanding the removal of a statue of Confederate President Jefferson Davis from the Kentucky Capitol. The statue, one of five honoring famous Kentuckians, has stood in the rotunda since its 1936 unveiling. It stands just behind the right shoulder of a statue of another favorite son, Abraham Lincoln. This is Talking History. Most of the colonies that came to comprise the United States were founded by religious individuals who insisted on established, official, churches in those colonies. Nevertheless, when we declared our independence and created a new nation, the founding fathers were just as insistent on separating church and state. How and why that came to pass as well as the history of religion in America, are the subject of this conversation between Talking History's Fred Nielsen and his guest, Mark Knoll.
Notwithstanding Thomas Jefferson's conviction that there should be a wall of separation between church and state, religion and politics have long been intertwined. Indeed, according to my guest Mark Knoll, American culture is, to a great extent, the distinctive result of the mutual influence of theological and secular ideas after the Revolution. A professor of history at Wheaton College, Mark Knoll is one of the nation's leading historians of religion. His most recent book is America's God, From Jonathan Edwards to Abraham Lincoln. Professor Knoll, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you today.
Well, let's start with Jonathan Edwards. He was one of the towering intellectual and religious figures of colonial America, and yet many people today, I think, probably remember him for just one sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Perhaps you could reintroduce him to us.
Yes, Jonathan Edwards was in the domains of religious thought what Benjamin Franklin was in practical reasoning and someone like James Madison was in political reasoning. That is to say, in the topics that he took up, Edwards was the great intellect of the century. He's important in my book as a kind of transitional figure, the last of the Puritans and the first of the modern religious Americans, or we might say evangelical Protestants. That transitional character makes him a very interesting person because, on the one hand, he did very well what others had done before him, and then he innovated in some interesting ways that had important consequences for what followed. He's far from a single-dimensional figure, and although Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God represents part of what he had to say, there was a lot more that he did say during his lifetime and has been published really to this very day.
What are the central ideas that he propounded?
Edwards was a great fan of some of Britain's most important intellects. He loved Sir Isaac Newton on the material world. He liked to read Locke on human psychology. He was an intent reader of Francis Hutcheson on the kind of ethics of the affections from Scotland. And yet in every case, he felt that these modern thinkers were taking steps that compromised or undercut traditional Christianity. So while he liked Newton, he also proposed an idealistic philosophy that he thought would avoid materialism. He liked Locke, but wanted to avoid what, for lack of a better term, we could call a kind of secular humanist psychology, and he liked Francis Hutcheson on the affections, but wanted to make sure that the role of God remained central in the affections. So that as a thinker, he was fully engaged with the main ideas of his day, but as a Christian thinker, a theologian, he was also using them and putting them into practice for his own purposes.
You observe that there was actually a decline in religious vitality during the American Revolution. Why was that?
A number of reasons obviously could be brought forward, but I think, in my view, the most important thing going on was a transition from inherited religious form to new religious form. Inherited religious form was primarily establishmentarian, a state church at the center of not just religious life, but community life. After the 1740s and 1750s in America, a number of things are working very strongly against that establishmentarianism. The revivals of the 1740s and 50s have placed a great emphasis on individual belief. The continuing of immigration to the colonies meant that there was more religious pluralism on the ground in colonial America than anywhere else, certainly in the British Empire, and maybe anywhere else in the world at the time. So the old pattern was breaking down. And when we get to the 1760s and 70s, there's a lot of excitement about the political changes, which probably also undercut the older churches. And a newer, more democratic, more individualistic style of religion had not yet arisen. So there was, in fact, a pretty serious decline, I think, in church participation, maybe even religious belief in the 1760s and 1770s.
Is it possible to briefly characterize the religious views of the founders themselves?
Yes, it is, although not probably in a way that connects with modern categories. Most of the major founders that we think of, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, were very seriously religious, but not traditionally Christian. They were all attached to Christian churches of one sort or another, but they would have been people on the forefront of what we might call Enlightenment thinking, and readier to dispense with what they regarded as old and faded dogmas of the Christian religion than would have been the populace at all, even though the populace at all was not a particularly church-going populace at the time.
One of those founders, Jefferson, is famous for having announced as a kind of prophecy that pretty soon the time was coming when we were all going to be Unitarians in America. He was, of course, dramatically wrong, as your book points out. The great surge in church membership after the Revolution is not in Unitarianism, but in evangelical Protestant churches like the Baptists and most particularly the Methodists. What was going on here? How are those churches, those evangelical churches, different, and what accounts for their dynamic growth?
Right, that is a key theme in the book, and I take two or three chapters to try to figure that out. My best answer right now is to say that groups like the Baptists, the Methodists, I would add the Disciples of Christ, the Christian Church, the Restorationist Movement, were adjusting to a free market in religion. They were groups that did not rely upon tradition, did not rely upon establishment, did not rely upon deference to inherited authority, but saw an opening, saw a need for religious proclamation, for the formation of churches, and simply went about doing the business without waiting for anyone to give them permission. Presbyterians did fairly well since they had come from the establishments of Scotland and the north of Ireland and had a period of adjustment. Congregationalists and Episcopalians did least well because they were the ones most firmly attached to the older way of doing things. I try to point out in the book, however, also that there was a certain sense in which all of the major religious groups, and at this time it would be almost exclusively Christian groups. There's a few Jews in the new United States, not many, almost nothing of the great pluralism we have today of religions from around the world. But the religious groups were effective in taking on board particularly the Republican thinking of the revolutionary founders. They were also effective in taking on the newer form of philosophical reasoning that sometimes goes by the phrase of common sense or common sense realism. Much more so than the founding fathers. They showed how a Republican way of organizing the political world, the social world, could be linked with a traditional Christian way of organizing the private and voluntaristic world. They really were more successful than the founding fathers in putting into practice a Republican polity, a society not governed by hereditary elites, but made up, and this is now modern jargon, made up as a kind of civil society of bourgeois, voluntaristic institution creating voluntarism.
In terms of specific theological principles or beliefs, how do things change as this transformation takes place? What would the religion of the Protestants of the early 19th century look like compared with, say, the earlier Puritans or even Edwards himself?
Right. This is the key question that got me into the project that led to the book, and it's one that seems to me to be quite an interesting and important one, because what happened over the course of a century, roughly from 1740 to 1840-1850, was that active participants in the churches came to take for granted different sets of reality. So I was able to find a number of interesting parallel sentences, 1740-1840. Everyone knows that, it can be assumed on all hands that, and then what finishes the sentence is exactly opposite. There is a great deal of continuity between the major evangelical Protestant groups of the mid-19th century and, say, the Puritans or Edwards of the 18th century. And that continuity, I think, is probably what comes through in popular treatments of early American religion to the extent that they exist. I focused more on the differences. Many of those differences had to do with the meanings of the one word freedom. Freedom was a term that was used in earlier America more, I think it's fair to say, with respect to a person's ability to do what he or she wanted to do. Later on, after the American Revolution, freedom refers to the choice that a person has to do what he or she wants to do. And that transition in the nature of freedom, which I think has everything to do with the struggle against Great Britain, the rise of a Republican political rhetoric, that change in what key words in religious and the public life meant, that led to big changes. So, for example, it was much harder in America in the 1840s to be a consistent Calvinist than it had been for Jonathan Edwards. Calvinism teaches God is in control of the world. Well, of course, Christians in the 1840s and 50s still said God was in control of the world, but their sense of how much authority over individual lives individuals themselves had was greatly enhanced from earlier days in the history of America. The Christian scriptures have always been important in the churches. In the 1840s and 50s, there's a lot more individual interpretation of the Christian scriptures than there have been in the 1740s and 1750s. There are many changes like this related to the broad participation of the churches in the large-scale national history of the intervening decades.
Lincoln observes at one point, it's in his second inaugural address, that Northerners and Southerners read the same Bible and prayed to the same God. And yet, in their Bibles, in their theology, they found no common ground at all on slavery.
That's right. And I do try to examine the cause for this painful and eventually tragic and violent situation. But my conclusion is that Northerners and Southerners, in fact, were using the same interpretive principles as they read the Bible, but that because of the democratic ethos, that the democratic principles that had come widely into play after the Revolution, there was no way of adjudicating by a higher authority contradictory interpretations of the Bible. Looking at things from our perspective, we can obviously see that Southern Christians upholding slavery would be most interested in passages in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, that seem to verify slavery. Northern abolitionists, of course, were looking at passages that would speak for greater freedom in Christ, freedom under God. And what took place by the time of the Civil War was a very deeply ingrained national culture of democratic Bible reading, but then a very strongly divided national culture on the basis of what that common Bible reading yielded by way of interpreting the scriptures.
Your book ends with Lincoln, who you said had a more profound theological understanding than most of the theologians of the day. What was Lincoln's understanding of America's God?
Lincoln is, of course, a crux to almost everybody's interpretation of the mid-decades of the 19th century. In my reading, Lincoln is wary about official Christian church religion, but he has a very strong belief in the general control by God over human affairs. A very, very famous memo that he wrote for himself shortly in the fall of 1862 when things were not going well for the North, in which he says what almost no one else at the time would say. Maybe God is not for either the North or the South. Maybe God has his own reasons for what's happening in the United States. That's a theme that comes back in the great words of the second inaugural. I would call Lincoln, I think, a profoundly theistic person, someone who had, in some sense, eventually came to a stronger view of God's control over providence than most of the church people of his day, but someone who, for a number of reasons, was not able to commit himself entirely to ordinary church Christianity as he'd experienced it at different times and different places of his life.
If American historical writing has a holy trinity over the last 20 or 30 years, it would be probably race, class, and gender. There's no doubt that historians have used these categories to enrich our understanding of the past, but they've sometimes, I think, pushed religion to the side. Your book can be read, at least I read it this way, as at least in part an argument for bringing religion back to center stage.
Yes, it certainly does seem to me that there are many of the key themes in American public life in which religion is central, especially in the first half of the 19th century. I would say, however, that it's easier to see how those themes are central if some of the excellent modern work on race, class, and gender is kept in view, which I to some extent at least try to do in this book. Americans were a religious people not in the sense that everyone was a practicing Christian, and by the time we get to the 1850s and 1860s, we do have more communities of Jews in the United States. And it's not even as though that the leading public religious voices were always so persuasive and so dramatically effective. But it is the case that in the realm of possible worlds of meaning, religious ones were central. The Christian churches were among some of the largest institutions in American society. The voluntary associations that were mostly religious were as big in some aspects as the federal government. The Methodist Church was more widely spread than the postal system, for example. So in an American society where there were not very many broadly dispersed public institutions and not many other broadly dispersed ideas than religious ideas, the church's religion was, to me, it seems extremely important.
Well, Professor Knoll, thank you so much for visiting.
It's been my privilege.
I've been talking with Mark Knoll, the author of America's God, From Jonathan Edwards to Abraham Lincoln.
Some of the things man has written are just too important to be lost or forgotten. They continue to be referenced in our conversations and to be an important part of our legacy to future generations. Well, now there's a site on the internet that makes thousands of those documents readily available to you. Here to tell you about the site is Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Whether you're looking for a widely available document such as the Declaration of Independence or Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 I Have a Dream speech, or more obscure texts such as Pennsylvania's Act for the Gradual Abolition of Slavery or the 1947 Treaty of Peace with Romania, the Avalon Project at the Yale Law School can help. This extensive website offers 7,000 full-text documents, ranging from a few sentences to entire books, related to law, history, economics, politics, diplomacy, and government. The documents are presented directly to the user with no historical or contextual information. They are divided chronologically into four categories: pre-18th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. Each category contains more than 150 documents, including treaties, presidential papers and addresses, statutes on slavery, and colonial charters, as well as state and federal constitutional and legal documents. Documents are also organized into more than 60 major collections, including Thomas Jefferson's papers, American diplomacy, the Cold War, and most recently the September 11 terrorist attacks. Another recent edition is entitled African Americans, Biography, Autobiography, and History. In addition to a keyword search, documents are listed alphabetically by author, subject, and title. Most documents are directly related to American history, but the site offers more than 100 items on ancient, medieval, and Renaissance history, as well as modern diplomatic documents, including close to 150 on the Middle East conflict. To locate Avalon, go to historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Avalon into the keyword search.
And finally, we turn to historical literary narratives and their value as sources from which we can learn about the past. Here to offer us his thoughts on the subject is S. Cushing Strout, Jr., Ernest White Professor of American Studies and Humane Letters Emeritus at Cornell University.
Border Country. Literary and historical narratives, as Wallace Stegner remarked, are not identical twins, but they are sisters. Ever since Sir Walter Scott established the historical novel in 1814, writers have often incorporated historical events and persons into their fictional stories, creating a border country between the imaginary and the actual. It can become a dark and bloody ground, however, when there is a clash between the historical sense and the literary imagination. Historians must not invent characters, events, or documents while fiction writers need some room for their creative inventions. In his book, The Historical Novel, Georg Lukács suggested some handy rules of thumb to reduce such conflicts. The writer can focus on a general social and cultural milieu rather than on famous public events, view actual historical persons through the eyes of other people, and dramatize little-known or undocumented episodes in the lives of historical figures. Tracy Chevalier, in Girl with a Pearl Earring, for example, makes her protagonist a fictional maid to the painter Vermeer, and we see him through her eyes. She is also solidly established in the social setting of the 17th century Dutch Republic. The Vermeer portrait is unusual in looking at us over her shoulder as if she were about to speak, and the story gives her an appropriate voice. Max Bird's novel, Grant, respects Lukács' advice because Bird's focus is on the large canvas of the Gilded Age, and Grant himself was known as the American Sphinx, an enigma to his biographers, and therefore a good subject for a novelist's imagination. Bird mainly looks at Grant and his career through the eyes of others. Bird, in a postscript, explains that whenever possible, he has taken dialogue verbatim from letters, books, diaries, and so on. He admits that he has taken poetic license in his treatment of Henry Adams's novel Esther because there's no decisive evidence that his wife knew all along that he had written it. Michael Frayn's play, Copenhagen, seems to violate all Lukács's rules because all three of its characters are actual persons, two of them internationally famous physicists, and they speak their thoughts directly to us. Yet, Frayn ingeniously secures some artistic freedom for himself by having them look back on their discussion as posthumous persons. Moreover, the subject discussed in the play is not a major public event, but an informal meeting in 1941 between two scientists in Copenhagen, for which there are no documents, only uncertain and conflicting memories. The play exploits Werner Heisenberg's famous uncertainty principle in physics as a metaphor for the historical uncertainty about what he said to Niels Bohr in 1941 about the German and Allied nuclear programs. Uncertainty is often a skeptical, postmodern theme about the supposed inability of either fiction or history to get into referential relationship to anything outside our own imagination. Frayn, instead, insists that where there is ambiguity in the play about what happened, it's because there is in the recollections of the participants. These three writers demonstrate the continuing vitality of what the Victorian novelist George Eliot called the veracious imagination.
You've been listening to S. Cushing Strout, Jr., Emeritus Professor of American Studies and Humane Letters at Cornell University. Professor Strout's comments are drawn from his recently published book of essays on fictionalizing history, The Veracious Imagination. And that's it for another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments or suggestions at talkinghistory@umkc.edu. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beattie, assistant producer. Our Site of the Week segment on the Avalon Project was produced by Amanda Schumann of George Mason University's Center for History and New Media. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.